So today we actually complete our series on the Sermon on the Mount, that powerful group of teachings that is known as the very heart of Christianity. And we know that throughout the series, I've been using two primary sources. They are The Secret According to Jesus, Living a Joyful Life, I love that subtitle, by Ed Townley, and Emmett Fox's The Sermon on the Mount, The Key to Success in Life, by Emmett Fox. So when we started this series, we talked about Jesus standing with the disciples on the top of the mount, what is now called the Mount of the Beatitudes, on the Sea of Galilee. And we talked about how those Beatitudes were the perfect beginning for these lessons because they previewed so beautifully all the lessons that would follow. Equally important is an ending. And so today we are going to look at Jesus' ending, at least most of it, for this powerful sermon. We're going to look at what takeaway Jesus gives to his disciples before they walk together down that mountain back to the shores of the Sea of Galilee and face the multitudes who are waiting for them. So Jesus begins the end, you might say, with this familiar saying. He says, "Ask and it shall be given you. Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be opened for you. For everyone who asks receives. Everyone who seeks finds. And everyone who knocks, for everyone who knocks, the door will be open." Slightly different version there. Now, typical of Jesus' teachings, this has both literal, I'm playing with my microphone today, sorry, I think I've got it. This has both literal and symbolic meanings. Jesus has already told his disciples earlier, you'll remember if you were with us, to first seek the kingdom of God and all these things will be added to you, meaning all of our earthly wants and needs will be met, and our desires will be met. Next, he says, what we just heard, "For everyone who asks seeks, and everyone who searches will find, and everyone who knocks, the door will be opened." In other words, everyone who asks receives. And just 3 years later, three short years, near the end of his life on earth, Jesus will say to his disciples, "Truly, have faith in God. Truly, I tell you, if anyone says to this mountain, 'Go throw yourself into the sea,' and does not doubt in their hearts, but believes that what they say will happen, it will be done for them. Therefore, I tell you, whatever you ask for in prayer, believe it is yours, and it will be yours." Believe it will be received. And so this really is a recurring message of Jesus, not only during the Sermon on the Mount, but throughout his entire ministry, that when we pray in faith, believing in the perfect, omnipresent power of the divine, all things are possible on this physical plane. This teaching is the very foundation of what we in Unity call affirmative prayer. Jesus teaches here that there is an inexhaustible supply in the invisible realm, what we sometimes call the absolute realm, and that supply only awaits our claiming it. The manifestation depends on our understanding of faith and belief that what we desire is already ours. That's the whole foundation of affirmative prayer. Now, referring to Bible study, one of my favorite Bible scholars, Dr. Amy Jo Levine, says, you have to listen to this a little bit, "A text without a context is just a pretext for making it say anything one wants." Right? We can pull out little things of the Bible and we can make them say all sorts of things, and some of them aren't very pretty when they're pulled out separately. But really, Jesus is talking here about claiming our physical needs and wants, and Jesus is talking about much, much more. Ask, seek, and knock are not simply synonyms, meaning all the same thing, the same truth. They describe a three-step process about navigating this physical world as spiritual beings. First, we ask. No matter what is showing up in our lives, no matter what is showing up, we pause, we breathe, we ask the Christ of our being for guidance in our human experience. We claim, knowing, believing, all we need is available to us through the Christ within. So that's the first stage, that asking stage. Now we seek. After the asking, we seek. And what are we seeking? We're seeking Christ's guidance about which steps to take. In other words, we turn within for inspiration about putting our feet to our prayers, making it happen, co-creating with God. This is where we feel our Christ power. Here we explore our options, we make discerning judgments, and we stay centered in the light and love of the Christ. Now, I know I've used this riddle far too many times, and most of you know the answer. So if you know the answer, hold off. I'm going to let you say the answer in a minute. This is for those of you who haven't heard the riddle. Okay, here we go. Five frogs are basking on a log in the middle of the lake. One frog decides the lake looks beautiful, and he decides to jump in. How many frogs are left? All right, those of you who know the answer, say it.
Five.
Why? He decided he did not jump. That's exactly right. Deciding is not doing, okay? So when this process that we're working through has defined the door that we're invited to step through to continue our spiritual journey in our human skins, we have to make the move. We can't just decide. We have to do something with it. And that's where the third step comes in. Knock. Knock, and the door is opened. Knock, and we will step through that door into a new dimension of spiritual expression, following what guidance we've already received in the beginning of the process. This is sometimes called the Great Promise. And the Great Promise is absolute. It is absolute. If we completely and lovingly embrace the process, the result is guaranteed to be for our highest good. No exceptions. No exceptions. So now Jesus continues the same teaching by saying, "Is there anyone among you, slightly different version here, who, if they ask, if a child asks for bread, will you give him a stone? If he asks for a fish, would you give him a snake? If you then, though you are evil," meaning in error, how many of us who are parents feel like we're in error most of the time, right? In error about parentinghood, in error about showing our love. "If most of you who are in error know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father in heaven give good gifts to those who ask?" Now, this absolutely revolutionary teaching sounds kind of typical to us. We've heard it before, but it would have been mind-boggling to the chosen 12 on that hillside overlooking the Sea of Galilee. Later, Jesus calling God Father will be labeled as blasphemy by the Jewish leaders and really one cause of him being crucified. In the Hebrew Bible, the term father is used in context of father of nations. It's always about father of nations. But never ever have these disciples ever heard God referred to as a personal father. Yet in the Gospels, Jesus refers to God as Father 170 times. No, I know I'm a nerd, but I didn't count them, okay? But Bible scholars have counted them, and I believe it. 170 times in the four Gospels, he calls God Father. So now we know from our study of the Lord's Prayer that the Aramaic term used for Jesus was Abum, shortened to Abba, translated as Papa. A word signifying intimacy, love, trust, and oneness. Actually, in Aramaic, the word was used to describe both male and female. It wasn't just a male term. It was actually meant birther, creator, father, mother of the universe, pure, unconditional love. Now, the old law that the disciples had been under just absolutely demanded strict obedience to an authoritarian, arbitrary, often angry God. And in order to stay in good graces with a God like that, humankind had to strictly obey every single law. And there were many more than the 10. Read Leviticus, many more than the 10. But Jesus portrays the divine as the best example of fatherhood, of a devoted parent capable of great love for his or her offspring. Now, I know the cartoonist got this a little wrong. The images are wrong, but the idea is right. And the little boy says, "Dad, can you pass me the bread? And look what Papa has in his hand. Poisonous snake." Okay, I said the images are wrong, but it really does help us understand that Jesus is saying this is not the mother-father God that he's talking about. This is not that type of God at all. Jesus invites us to see God as a personal, loving parent, the divine source of unconditional love and all goodness. And next, Jesus calls us to be that love and goodness through our interactions with others. He says, "So in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you. For this sums up the law and the prophets." Of course, today we call this the Golden Rule. And popularly quoted, say it with me, you all know it, "Do unto others as you would have others do unto you." The wording the disciples would have been familiar with was, "What is hateful to you, do not do to your neighbor." This is the whole Torah. All the rest is commentary. I love that. All the rest is commentary. So Jesus has come, he said already, not to abolish the old law, but to fulfill it, right? So he's emphasizing that avoiding hateful behavior is simply not enough. It's a good thing to avoid hateful behavior, but it's not enough. We are to treat others with the same compassion that we ourselves desire. Now, we're going to do a whole lesson on the Golden Rule in 2019, but for now, let's just imagine together what the world would be like if this simple guideline were followed. Imagine no judgments, no exclusion of others, no hateful comments to one another, or hateful or hurtful, no ego-driven competition, no better-than stuff, no violence, no war, no enemies to forgive, because every single thought, word, and deed would be an expression of love. What would that world be like? Next, Jesus says, "Enter through the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction, and many enter through it. But small is the gate and narrow is the road that leads to life, and only a few find it." This has been a confusing teaching for some people through the years. Townley says, Jesus makes it clear here that the path he calls every one of us to embrace, the path of realizing and expressing our Christ nature, is not always an easy one. Let's be honest, it isn't. We went over all of the core values and the descriptions this last week at the board meeting, and one of the board members said, "You know, this is so beautiful, but it's not easy." And it's not easy every single moment to live from this consciousness. It takes courage to stand firm against the general flow of belief in a punishing God and the idea that life is designed to be a deliberately painful experience, which is what some people believe. And you know the old saying, "You shall know the truth, and the truth will make you odd." Right? Right? It takes strength to hold fast to Jesus' message of oneness with a loving God and to the idea of personal empowerment, that we actually are co-creating this new consciousness that Jesus calls the kingdom of heaven on this earth. So the wide open gate and the super highway, that'll have a lot of traffic on it, just like 270 at rush hour, right? A lot of people on it. And joining in that traffic jam might seem like the only right decision. But the wide gate and the broad road symbolize the way of the world, living from what Unity co-founder Charles Fillmore called sense consciousness, focusing only on immediate gratification, power, human demands, and distractions. However, remember Robert Frost's words from one of my very favorite poems, The Road Not Taken. He said, I took the path less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. Ed Townley writes, Jesus assures us in this teaching there is a private path for every single one of us. It's not for the faint of heart. It is narrow and sometimes difficult to navigate, but the rewards are great. The narrow road or the narrow path does not, as we might fear, take us out of our human experience, but deeper into it. Our humanity and our spirituality are one. This is the path of life experienced from the fresh, loving, unique perspective of spirit. This is the path of spiritual empowerment and personal freedom. The path that allows us to be free to be all that we can imagine God to be. We are on this earth to embrace our human experience and transform it into the kingdom of heaven. So this path leads to harmony and truth, and as Jesus says, it leads to life as a spiritual power. Our Unity co-founder Charles Fillmore defines life as the expression of being which manifests as animation, activity, and vigor. I think you can feel this in this sanctuary on a Sunday morning when people are coming and greeting and being together. You can just feel that vigor and that activity. Life is a divine idea. It's the energy that propels all forms to action. The river of life, Charles Fillmore says, is within man's own consciousness. Contact to this divine energy is made through prayer, meditation, and good works. So being on this path, this road, this narrow road, means we remain singularly focused. Remember the single eye? Those who were with us a few weeks ago in the Sermon on the Mount where Jesus talks about the single eye. We keep our single eye focused on the underlying spiritual energy and purpose that give everything in our lives meaning. So Jesus' final teaching in this amazing series of lessons is one you probably remember this from being a child in Sunday school. I remember this story. I love the story. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against the house. Yet it did not fall, because it had its foundation on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice, does not put them into action, in other words, remember the frog, right, is like a foolish man who built his house on sand. The rain came, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against the house, and it fell with a great crash. Emmett Fox calls this illustration, he says, for its simplicity, directness, and graphic power, it's unmatched outside the teachings of Jesus, which is a beautiful metaphor. And here Jesus says that simply hearing the words, it's not enough unless we act upon them. And if we just hear them and do not act upon them, that is building a shaky foundation for spiritual possibility. Remember, as I said, the frog. The Gospels tell us that Jesus was a carpenter, right? We know that, taught by his father Joseph. Actually, the Greek word translated as carpenter was tekton, which meant not just a carpenter of wood. It was more of a general term. It meant an artisan in wood, iron, or stone. And considering that most of the houses in that area and in that time and place were, many of them at least, were built into the caves. Bob and I saw this when we were in Jerusalem, built into the side of the caves. Jesus might have been a stonemason and not a wood carpenter at all. Either way, we can see his trade in forming the metaphor, can't we? This is something he knew a lot about. And since it was common practice at the time for people living in hilly regions, as I said, to build into those hollow caves, the disciples would immediately understand Jesus' message. They really got this one. So the wise man builds his house on rock, symbolizing the foundation of spiritual principle, which nothing can shake. Later, Jesus will call that rock faith, Remember when he says to Peter, upon this rock I shall build my church. He's not talking about a physical rock. He's talking about the rock of faith, spiritual consciousness of faith. But the foolish man builds his house on shifting sand, something else the disciples would have been familiar with in that desert climate. But they symbolize the superficial life with no spiritual foundation. Now, here's another subtle point to this teaching that sometimes we don't think about. Notice that building a house on the rock of strong, spiritual foundation does not prevent the storms from coming, the rains from falling, or the winds from beating on the house. Well, darn. You know, we think if we do all of our spiritual work, nothing bad's going to happen to us on this plane of existence, but that's not always the way it happens. But remember, both houses face the same storm, but what is the difference? Tell me what the difference is. Right, one survives, one has the foundation to survive, the other collapses. That's exactly right. And as long as we are in our human skins, we may face storms and challenges, and they may be part of our experiences. But here's the thing. Ed Townley says, those storms may continue to rage, but when we exercise our foundation and faith, we experience the storms without judgment or blame, doing what is ours to do to dissolve the negative energy. So grounded on that foundation of truth, of divine law, and our own spiritual identity, we can, and we do every day, weather the storms of temporary illness, the flooding streams of apparent lack, and the brutal winds of blustery human relationships, knowing, not guessing, not thinking, but knowing that through the indwelling, loving Christ, we have all the faith, strength, and power we need to prevail. There's an old story about a rich man who hired a builder to build, in his words, the most magnificent house that has ever been built. He says to the builder, spare no expense. So when the house was finished, the builder was proud of it. Until the rich man said to him, now, this house is yours, and you are going to live in it. And all of a sudden, the builder began to see these little flaws that he hadn't bothered to cover up. You know, these cracks in the walls and all these different things that he hadn't seen before. And the moral of the story is, each of us is building our own house, day by day, thought by thought. And that house has got to be strong enough to survive what we're going to face on this physical plane. So, that I should say, every house is tested. Let's say it that way. We each have to build our own house, and every house may be tested. And now Matthew ends the Sermon on the Mount with this. He says, and it came to pass when Jesus had ended these sayings that the people were astonished at his teachings, for he taught them as one having authority and not as the scribes. Now, Matthew seems to be telling us here that not only the 12 gathered on the hillside, the 12 chosen few overlooking the Sea of Galilee during this incredible sermon, series of lessons, not only were they astonished, but afterwards, when Jesus and the 12 come down the mountain to be in the midst of the multitudes and share the teachings with all who are gathered there, everyone who hears them is astonished. The difference between the teachings of Jesus and the teachings of the scribes, is compelling. The authority of Jesus is the authority of the divine, and we are no longer dependent on anyone telling us the word. We don't have to receive it from anyone else. The interpreter's Bible says, the scribes quoted authorities. Jesus was authority. The scribes drew stale water from closed wells, same teachings over and over again. But the words of Jesus were like a spring, clear, fresh, pure, with power to shake the soul's thirst. In other words, the scribes were powerful. Jesus was power-filled. And like so many of us, when we first discover those teachings of truth, the people said to themselves, this is what I have always known. deep within my heart. How many of you experienced that when you first found Unity? I did. I was like, oh my gosh, I didn't know anybody taught this, but this is what I've always believed. The thing is, the spirit of truth is within you. The light and the love of God is within you, and it will echo in your heart as long as your heart is open to receive. And so we complete our journey through the Sermon on the Mount, hopefully with greater awareness of the essence of Jesus' teachings. Ed Townley writes, as spiritual beings engaged in this somewhat intense and confusing experience of human life, sometimes we do block our spiritual energy with fearful illusions of lack, limitation, and weakness. These negative images arise from false beliefs that we are distant from God. The truth is, we are eternally one, as our daily word said. We are eternally one with God through the Christ within, the expression of all God is. So throughout the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus shows us how to use the power and potentiality within to create love, peace, and joy in our lives and in the world. As we align with that creative energy and the perfect power of God, moment by moment, thought by thought, act by act, we create the kingdom of heaven on earth. And so it is. So let's take a moment now to just affirm the great truth about the divine. And for those of you who are here for the first time, this is printed in your bulletin. There is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life. God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is. Together, there is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life. God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is.